ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we hear part two of four of a friendly conversation between leading skeptic Michael Shermer and Stephen C. Meyer, author of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. We begin with Shermer referring to their discussion so far on the three major discoveries that Meyer explores in the book. And he's wondering now about a fourth one he thinks Meyer might also have included.
Yeah, I was surprised you didn't have a fourth line of inquiry, that is the moral law within. You know, Immanuel Kant's famous line about the two great mysteries of the world are the starry heavens above and the moral law within. Is that your next book, or did you just not have enough space for that?
I think there's a great, I used to teach that argument. I have a Steve Meyer version of it, if you will. But I think that valuing is something that only persons can do. I'll give you my version of the moral argument. I used to do this in Intro to Philosophy. Valuing is something that only persons can do. All ethical systems are based on underlying values. For example, the intrinsic value of human life. If there isn't an objective valuer, a single person whose opinion about what is most important counts most, then we will necessarily get multiple systems of valuing and therefore multiple systems of ethics, and therefore we will devolve into relativism. But none of us actually live as though all ethics are purely relative, that ethical propositions are only applicable to individual persons or groups. We all in our behavior reveal that we accept an objective ethical system when it's our ox that's being gored, or our mother who's being kicked in the shins, or our child is being abused. Therefore, we act as though there is an objective ethical system. Theism, insofar as it provides posits a single ethical opinion that matters more than any other, because theism posits a designer who made the ethical system to encourage human flourishing, provides the best grounding for something that we all tacitly end up revealing that we believe in, which is an objective moral proposition.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm a moral objectivist and realist as well, even though I'm an atheist. And I think you can derive it, although
How does that work? Yeah, I'm interested. How does that work for you, Michael? I mean, your
grounding? Well, it's kind of another long, that was my podcast episode this last week.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, with two theistic philosophers. I didn't even know they were theistic, James Hunter and Nedelecki. Their book was, let me just get that straight for my...
He's the sociologist of religion at Virginia, right?
Yes, correct. Yes, correct. Yeah, that's right. Let me give you the title of their book here, sorry. This is this week's James Hunter and Paul Nedelecki, right? So their book is Science and the Good, The Tragic Quest for the Foundations of Morality. To their credit, as I told them, halfway through our podcast, when I found out they were theists, I had no idea they were theists. I mean, I read their entire book because I was asked to review it, because they critiqued me and Steve Pinker and Sam Harris and others. And so, to their credit, they made all the arguments without ever invoking religion or God or anything like that. So I gave them
So they were reasonable guys in spite of their disreputable.
That's right.
Beliefs.
That's right. Now that I know you're a theist, okay, now we're going to take the gloves off. No, just kidding.
Now we're going to really.
Agree that it takes persons, in the sense that, like all the primate research that Franz de Waal does, you know, primate politics, and they have these kind of pre-moral sentiments. But that's different than the kind of values you're talking about. I think humans are special in that sense. It probably takes some kind of abstract reasoning, maybe even language, to scale up from these kind of pre-moral sentiments that primates have, or maybe all mammals. And then you go from there. I was glad you quoted Dawkins. Let me just read that again. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, I listened to the reading of your book, and I noticed it kept coming up over and over and over, and I have a PDF, so I just did a scan of the word pitiless indifference, blind, pitiless indifference. 13 times you quoted this. So I gather this
is
a
money
important.
Quote, my friend, it, because he does such a beautiful job of framing the issue, you know.
But you see,
is it or is it not the case that the properties of the universe are what we'd expect on naturalism or materialism, or are the properties what we'd expect on theism? And I think it suggests
but what
the
I'm
testability
asking is
of
that,
metaphysical hypotheses.
That last part.
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
That last part, there's no good or evil. It's just pitiless indifference. My sense is that's what really bothers you, as it would anybody.
No, I'm interested in the metaphysical question itself. I mean, I'm not one of these people that's a theist because if there were no God, that my fragile psyche couldn't take it. I cite Lawrence Krauss at the end. He says the universe doesn't owe us comfort. And so I want to know what's true. And what I appreciate about, you know, a number of the new atheists is they took religion seriously enough to say, is it true or not? I think there are a lot of people in the pews that actually don't really believe very much of it. And I think the starting point is to determine, well, is there or is there not a God? I mean, that's a very important question. Or is materialism true? Is it, are matter and energy the eternal self-existent entities from which everything else came, the ontological ground of all being, as the philosophers would put it, or the prime reality? Or is it a personal agent? That's been something we've debated in Western philosophy since the Greeks, and I thought, let's get it on, you know, and weigh the arguments on both sides. And his way of framing it also dovetails to this whole Bayesian abductive approach to evaluating propositions, which I thought was really helpful.
Where I depart,
sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's okay. When I depart from Dawkins and maybe Ed Wilson as well on this, Ed made the distinction between empiricists and transcendentalists. Not the transcendentalist, but something different. That is it just what we see, materialist, or can we transcend something? To me, it's transcendent to think that we are born with a nature that has a sense of right and wrong and guilt and shame. That comes with the species. It's not subjective just to me or my family, my group, my tribe, my nation, Western culture, whatever. There are certain values that are really objectively wrong. And, you know, so I start with Lincoln. If slavery is not wrong, nothing's wrong. And, well, how do you know it's wrong, you know, outside of, you know, Lincoln and Western culture or whatever? Well, because you just ask the slave, you know, would you rather be free or would you rather be enslaved? Would you rather be, you know, satiated or would you rather be hungry? Would you rather be in pain or would you rather be out of pain? And so on. You can just kind of go through these basics of life and, you know, people vote with their feet, literally. Or their dollars, or they vote with their behaviors, what they want. And so we can make, you know, general conclusions about what's objectively right and wrong from there. And to me, I in my other work, I try to scale up from Dawkins' selfish gene model to, you know, this kind of reciprocal altruism, kin selection, reciprocal altruism, and so on, that, you know, as Dawkins says in the selfish gene, that the difference between, let's say, a rock and a lump of food. A lump of food is an animal, and the rock won't kick back if I kick it, but the animal will. So, and I know that the animal knows that it doesn't want to be in pain. So I have to, you know, act in a different way than I would with a stone. And if it's another human, I know that he knows that I know I'm selfish, and I know that he knows that I know that he knows that he's selfish, and so on. So we have to, you know, act in a moral way. Now, one more step. It's not enough to fake being a good person, a moral person, a caring person, because we give off tells. You know, Bob Trivers talked about self-deception. You know, cult leaders or whatever, they believe their own lies because they're better at able to pitch what they're selling. But we have lie detection circuitry that looks for cues, like this person's bullshitting me or exaggerating or lying. And so there's this kind of arms race, evolutionary arms race between lying and lying detection. And so it's not enough to say I'm a good person or I'm a moral person. You actually have to act it. And even there, you could give off subconscious cues or tells that you're faking it. So you actually have to believe it. Like, I really actually care about you, not just pretending in a Machiavellian, manipulative, dark triad, narcissistic way. I actually do believe it and feel it. And that's, to me, that's genuine morality. It's as good as anything that is on offer from theists, as I see it, because you guys have the problem of of the Euthyphro problem. You know, if God handed us these moral values, you know, how do we know what they are? Well, we get them out of holy books. Well, you know, those holy books conflict with each other. But in any case, does God endorse moral values that are objectively right and wrong? And if so, why can't we just go straight to the source? And why do we have to, you know, read it in a book or whatever? Can we discern it some way? Or is it only what he says is right and wrong? You know the problem, of course. So anyway, to me, I think we can derive those. I'm way down a sidetrack because I just said, why don't you have four of them? Maybe that's your next book. we'll do another.
Well, and we should stipulate that I don't really address the moral argument. I do make an epistemological argument. I think theism uniquely grounds belief in the reliability of the mind. And I discuss that in the very last chapter of the book. And I think theistic presuppositions about the intelligibility of nature and the reliability of the mind were crucial to the rise of modern science during the period we call the scientific revolution. But on the moral argument, just to, I've never heard you unpack your take on it that before. That's really interesting. My take on it is that the evolutionary account of that it's entirely possible to discern ethical principles, what we should do, but they all presuppose an underlying value that to the individual that's difficult to account for on an evolutionary and materialistic worldview. And secondly, if we give an evolutionary account of the origin of moral motions or intuitions or principles, I don't think that the evolutionary account withstands its own exposure. As soon as I know that what I regard as moral, inviolate moral principles are just something that were programmed into me in order to enhance either my survival or the survival of the group that I'm part of, I don't really have a reason to continue to obey them if the moral principles cut against my survival, my survival interests in the moment. So anyway, it's a big discussion, but I'm glad we should continue. I think I'm relieved to know you're a moral objectivist. I think that explains why you and I have some very similar political views about free speech and libertarian, you know, the importance of liberty and things like that. So anyway, come back at it.
That in itself would be a fundamental. You got to start somewhere. So I start with this kind of fundamental autonomy and freedom that it's my body and my choices and so on. But I know you have yours as well. So for me to appeal to you using reason and rational arguments for why you should be nice to me, I have to take you seriously and show you that I should be nice to you. And this is kind of a foundation of moral exchange.
Yeah, I think you could get to some specific agreed moral principles in that sort of interpersonal negotiation, accounting for the difference between is and ought, when oughts are expression of underlying values, and we want our ought statements to be universal, suggests the need for a universal source of those, the values that underline the oughts. So a universal person rather than your opinion versus mine. It is really interesting in that Dawkins quote that we were bandying back and forth, that he says there's no evil, no good. His version of materialism does lead to a form of relativism. And I think you're somewhat unusual among people with a naturalistic worldview in affirming moral objectivity. There was a famous Nelson who did as well.
Yeah, I am. I am unusual that way, although I'm not the only one. Pinker and Sam Harris as well. But Robert Pennock makes the argument, because I sent him all my stuff and said, what do you think? Because I'm not a philosopher and I don't even play one on TV. And he said, well, this starting with the survival and flourishing of yourself and, you know, the human condition and the betterment of survival and flourishing for others and so forth, that in itself as a foundation point has an ought built into it. He convinced me that you cannot truly derive an ought from just is, that one of the premises probably has an ought built into it, which was Hume's original point. So I take him to be correct on that. And so what? Okay. So, you know, again, just ask the slave, would you rather be enslaved or free? He's going to say, I want to be free. Okay. Well, how do we know? Well, because he just said so. All right. So, I mean, the person is expressing their desire in that sense. Okay. That's a slave. But a second point on Dawkins' quote, because here I think we're making an error that I call Alvey's error, that is assessing the purpose of something at the wrong level of analysis. Alvey Singer, Woody Allen's character in Annie Hall, where, recall in the movie, he has that flashback to childhood. where he is no longer doing his homework, and his mother takes him to the psychiatrist. And Albie, why won't you do your homework? He says, because the universe is expanding. And he says, what? He says, well, the universe is expanding, and someday it's going to all blow up. So it doesn't make any difference whether I do my homework or not. And his mother upbraids him and says, what's the universe got to do with it? We live in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn's not expanding. And I use this. That's this is one of my gallon. Yeah, this is one of my Scientific American columns, because I was responding to one of William Lane Craig's debates that I watched with him and Shelley Kagan about that, well, as he said here, on a naturalistic worldview, everything is ultimately destined to destruction and the heat death of the universe. As the universe expands, it grows colder and colder and heats up, and you know, then nothing means anything. So Kagan responded to that. Oh, because Craig had brought up that, you know, godless Nazi torturers, they got away with it. So it didn't matter. And so, and Kagan is Jewish, and he's like, this strikes me as an outrageous thing to suggest. It doesn't really matter. Surely it matters to the torture victims whether they're being tortured. It doesn't require that this makes some cosmic difference to the eternal significance of the universe for it to matter whether a human being is tortured. It matters to them, it matters to their family, and it matters to us. And then Craig committed a related fallacy when he argued that without God, there are no objective moral values, moral duties, or moral accountability. And if life ends at the grave, then ultimately it makes no difference whether you live as Stalin or as a Mother Teresa. So I call this Craig's categorical error, assessing the value of something by the wrong criteria, category of criteria. So, for example, we live in the here and now, not the hereafter, so our actions must be judged according to the criteria of this category, whether or not the category of a God-granted hereafter exists. Whether you behave like a Russian dictator who murdered tens of millions of people or a Roman Catholic missionary who tended the poor matters very much to the victims of totalitarianism and poverty. And then, so why does it matter? Well, because this is in our nature. We don't want to suffer.
Well, it matters to the individual person, but the idea of morality, as you point out, is that it is universal and it must be transpersonal. And one of the problems with tyrants is that there was no principle that they acknowledged that applied not only to themselves but to the people they tortured. So I know this is a deep question in moral philosophy, but I think that the underlying all ethical propositions are beliefs about values, and I think if you want an objective system of morality that transcends our individual opinions about what is valuable, there must be a valuer who has a claim on his opinion counting more. And I think if there is a creator who made us all with certain design parameters, then if there's a moral law that is offered to advance human flourishing, then I think the theistic account enables us to have that objective morality and have it grounded. But, you know, there's a ton more to say about this. We won't settle this one, but
Dawkins is interesting this way, because
it's not an argument I make in the book.
So. Yeah, no, I understand. It's okay. But one final point on that, that Dawkins himself is not a moral relativist. He, you know, as you know, he has no qualms about criticizing Islam and say female genital mutilation as being objectively wrong. This is horrible. And he rants about this. So clearly, even he, with that famous quote.
That implies that female persons are valuable, and that begs a question. Legrand says, who? Are they valuable only to the female persons who are being mutilated, or only to Richard Dawkins, or are there objective principles above us all to which we can appeal that reflect a valuation that is not derivative of our subjective opinions?
Yeah, well, I say the latter.
I think theism says, yes, there is, and I can tell you where that comes from. And I think, you know, the Harvard law professor Harold Berman said, underneath all ethical systems is an unspoken question, which he said, the grand says who question. And if the grand says who is always answered by, well, me or you, I, thou, you know, then we're going to get a lot of different moralities coming out of that. And I think for those of us who accept moral objectivism, I think that's a problem. And I think theism solves that problem. I don't think an evolutionary account of morality does. I think we end up realizing that you know, in the same way, I think the evolutionary account, once we understand that the moral principles or our sense of what's valuable has been programmed into us for survival only, if my survival interests depart from the group, I have no compelling reason to continue to go with the dominant morality of the group.
Well, the group will. They will isolate you if you don't play nice. Right?
Yeah, but then you're back to nature, red tooth and claw, and that's not really what we mean by morality. So this is a good discussion, Mike. We should do this more. We should do one of these just on this topic.
If on your take is correct, then why do we need a military and police, and why do we have a judicial system? People do need to be encouraged to bring out the better angels of their nature and sequester their inner demons.
Theism has its own answer to that. Yeah, for sure. But that's the human nature problem that theologians discuss is related to our instinctive rebellion against the creator.
Okay, methodological naturalism. Okay, I agree with you. I agree with you that it is an assumption built into science. Okay, so as opposed to what? What would, say, methodological supernaturalism look like?
Philosophy of science that would not limit would not say that we must limit explanatory hypotheses to postulations that affirm only materialistic entities. In other words, the kind of science that was practiced by Newton, Boyle, and Kepler, who got science going. The methodological naturalism is an artifact of late 19th century, largely historical or evolutionary biology. It was implicit in the Origin of Species. And Darwin made arguments that presupposed that science must not consider creative intelligence. That's okay if he wants to do that, but I think we need to be explicit about that. And so when we're making, here's an example that I sometimes use. If you walk into the British Museum and you look at the Rosetta Stone, and someone says, "Well, how do you think those etchings got there?" You know, and you say, "Well, I think it must have been wind and erosion." Well, we know something about the origin of information. It always comes from mines. We've got informational inscriptions in three different languages that have been translated back and forth. People will laugh, and rightly so, because our conviction, if we applied methodological naturalism in that case, we would be limiting the intellectual freedom of the scientist, archaeologist to follow the evidence where it most naturally leads, given our knowledge of cause and effect. So I think we need to be open to, when we're talking about causal origins questions, and you made a good point a minute ago, I was going to amplify that about your Woody Allen illustration, the wrong level of analysis. It's really important to keep the context of inquiry in mind in science. There are a whole swath of questions where intelligent design, the God hypothesis, an evolutionary explanation are not relevant because the science isn't dealing with causal origins questions or historical questions about how things got here. Most of science is concerned to describe how nature acts. One part of nature affects another part of nature, how nature acts in a regular way on an ongoing basis. It's not asking a question of the form, what caused something to come into existence? It's asking a question of the form, what does nature ordinarily do? And if I say, well, God did it, or intelligent design was responsible, or it evolved that way, I've answered the wrong question. But there is a class of scientific questions that are concerned with causal origins. And if I ask, well, how did the universe acquire the fine-tuning that's necessary to life? Or where did the effectively digital form of information that resides in DNA come from in the first place? Those are questions that might have adequate answers by reference to strictly materialistic causes or forces, but the right answer might be that creative intelligence had something to do with the fine tuning. After all, Fred Hoyle, longtime atheist, converted to a proto form of theism on the basis of the fine tuning parameters that he himself discovered, and said a common sense interpretation of the evidence we have of fine tuning suggested a super intellect monkey with physics and chemistry. So the argument here is that there is a class of scientific questions that should be open to creative intelligence as a possible explanation if the evidence warrants. And so the opposite of rigidly applying methodological naturalism in all categories of scientific endeavor is a more open philosophy of science that allows the context to dictate the allowable range of questions, and then is open to all such possible explanations that are relevant to the question that's being asked. And that, by the way, was a very productive form of inquiry during the period of the scientific revolution. And I would also argue it's becoming productive in our larger network of ID scientists who are using design as a heuristic to generate specific predictions about what you ought to find in living systems, and then going out and looking for those design patterns that you might find or that might be there if life was in fact designed. I'll give you a few examples of that.
Yeah, okay. So the archaeologist who uncovers the Rosetta Stone infers intelligent mind behind it, but they know that there are intelligent minds. They're called people, and they lived in the past before us. And we can dig around in Greece and find, oh, well, there's their tools and artifacts, and there's some graves, and they're their bones. What would be the equivalent of that for, say, DNA or the fine-tuning of the cosmos?
That's a really common objection to my argument, Michael, and I just put that one deeply, firmly to rest in signature in the cell in the first place. Let me give you an illustration that gets at the principle. Let's say you're an archaeologist and you're going into some, you discover some caves under the ice pack in Antarctica, and you go into the caves. You've assumed that no one has ever lived on the Antarctic continent. It's been way too cold for way too long. But you go in and you discover on the walls of the cave some scratchings that look like inscriptions. And at first you think, oh, it might have been, you know, leaching or erosion or something. But then you find more of them, and they've got little pictograms of animals. And as you begin to study them carefully, as the archaeologist did with the Rosetta Stone, you begin to correlate the pictograms and the inscriptions. You realize this is actually a form of linguistic communication. Now you have to readjust your assumption that there was no life, there was no intelligent life prior to the discovery of this cave on Antarctica, because you found a distinctive hallmark of intelligent activity. When there's one and only one known cause for a given effect, you can reason retrodictively from the effect back to the cause, even if you didn't know that the cause was present prior to the time where you're investigating. And so I think that means that we need to be open to the possibility of intelligence, even if we don't know there was an intelligence present prior to the origin of life on Earth, for example. Because there could be distinctive indicators of intelligent activity from a time or from a place or from a domain that is that we were not previously able to verify.
So the mind would be something like our mind, but smarter, bigger, more powerful, or whatever.
Quite possibly. We're finding, for example, one of the predictions of an ID model is that we would find sophisticated design patterns using the term of art from computer science in living cells. A design pattern in computer science is a known method of storing or transmitting or processing information. We have a Microsoft elite level architect programmer who's helped us write 10,000 lines of code to simulate the gene expression system in the DNA. He told me it's full of computer design patterns that we recognize, only they're operating at an 8.0, 9.0, 10.0 efficiency beyond they're far more elegant than the design, the similar design patterns that we've used. That suggests maybe the mind is superior to ours.
Yeah. You go back to your example of the cave in Antarctica. Let's say that cave was dated, I don't know, 10 million years ago. Well, this would be quite the find. And, you know, there are some people who think that, you know, humans existed, you know, advanced civilizations long before ours, but this would be way, way before. But I don't think anybody would posit a supernatural agency. They would just say, wow, I guess our archaeology is completely wrong.
That wasn't the point of that illustration. It was just the idea that you would posit an intelligence from a time and a place that preceded known human intelligence to that point in your knowledge. The people that are searching for extraterrestrial intelligence do not know that ET is out there. But if they find the prime number sequence embedded in a radio signal or something even more sophisticated by way of information content, they're going to infer that an intelligence existed in a place and from a time before which previously from a time and place that previously we didn't think there was any intelligence. If we discover fine tuning at the foundation of physical laws and in the initial conditions of the universe, by the same logic, it's completely reasonable to think that there might have been an intelligence acting before the beginning of the universe on the entire universe. So I think we have to decide the nature.
I'm following you there.
Whether or not we have intelligence and the nature of intelligence by the nature of the effect that we find.
Yeah, I'm following the sequence. But again, if we discover some carvings in the rock or something like this, we know how intelligent minds have done this in the past. They use stone tools or they use copper chisels or whatever. But so my next question would then be, where is this mind in the universe or outside of it? And more importantly, how would it create the signal that somehow is obviously different than just using stone tools or copper tools or whatever? How does the mind interact with the stuff? So this gets to one more point. The mind-body problem, you know, how does the thought interact with
exactly
the physical substance? In another area, I like to tell my ghost hunting friends, how does the ghost know to go right at the hallway and knock the painting off the wall? It's supposedly this non-material stuff. How does it interact with the stuff?
Right, right.
Okay, you see where I'm going with that.
Well, yeah, I do. The methods of design detection that intelligent design proponents use allow us to retrodict to the activity of mind without answering the question of how minds affect the material world around us. People may say, well, that's a terrible cop-out. You haven't answered the question going in the forward direction of time. How does mind affect matter? But we don't actually know that with our own minds. And this is the mind-body problem. And as Gould used to point out, concerning evolutionary biology, he said we can often know that something happened without exactly knowing how the cause what caused it. So we can infer the activity of intelligence without knowing exactly how intelligence affects matter. You and I are constraining possibility space right now as we consider a nearly infinite range and combination. I'm sorry, I've got someone else trying to call me. I'll just turn them off here.
I have one too. All right.
Yeah, sorry. The perils of being in Zoom and Skype touch with the whole world, right? Yeah. Oops. So anyway, where was I? Yeah. So the idea is that we're making a limited claim here. We can infer the activity of mind. We're not saying we've solved the mind-body problem, either for the way the human mind affects the matter around it or for the way in which the designing mind responsible for the fine-tuning or the origin of life affected matter in the physical universe, the mind of God, if you will.
That was Stephen C. Meyer speaking with skeptic Michael Shermer in the second part of a four-part series originally hosted on Shermer's podcast channel. For more great conversations on evolution, intelligent design, and their scientific and philosophical implications, stay tuned to ID the Future at your favorite podcast app, or find us at idthefuture.com. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.